Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
This is Steve Cole from the Cole Ranch, a horse farm and training center located in California. We offer folks the chance to join hands with us to own a young racehorse from our farm. We're dramatically different compared to most popular racing partnerships because we don't charge fees or commissions, and we don't inflate the value of the horse. Most racing partnerships buy a horse at auction for, say, $100,000, then turn around and sell shares for $200,000. We value our horses realistically and don't add on fees or commissions. Right now, Cole Ranch is selling shares in a two-year-old Calbred colt named Mr. Wickham. He's by Heatseeker out of Serena's Echo, our stakes-producing mare, who is a full sister to multimillionaire Thor's Echo. You can get into this horse for as little as $1,000, which will entitle you to a 5% interest. If you want to invest in this horse, please call me at area code 805-990-3669 or visit us on the web at thecoleranch.com.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
Good lead in because we love Lenny and Steve, and there's been a few too many visits where we had one on the phone. Here you go, fellas. Look, that for you. I brought a bagel. It's not the same as our big Thursday lunch with corned beef and pastrami, but it's bagels.
Yes, can we have these to go?
You don't have it turned on. All right, there you go. Try now.
Hello? Am I on? Hey, am I on the air?
It's the boy singer.
It's a Dom Herrera routine.
I think it I'm on. I can't tell.
You are.
Yes,
you're on.
You're
we
on,
can hear you.
You're on
drugs. By the way, you realize that the most feedback I get from whenever I come on a show, and my show, by the way, is people who love when I talk about knishes and food and stuff. So here we are right here staring at a bag of bagels, and I'm definitely going to take a couple to go because they look awfully New Yorkish.
As opposed to where? I mean, come on.
As opposed to Nebraska.
You're taking them to go?
To go. I'm going to eat it now. We just had a big breakfast.
All right. The mic has to follow your mouth.
Aren't you glad I'm the one that's what have
you? What?
You want the headphones?
I keep thinking I'm on stage, so.
You are.
You yeah. Stick Apollo 40 on me. I taught him that move. I taught him that move. That's my move.
I don't yeah. see, Steve, I don't I see you playing joints.
I don't know the lyrics to Ajita.
With the special lyrics about the moon landing.
So this is okay. Like this is incredible. This is like Michael Jordan coming back from retirement, right? It's like
no,
Lassie comes
like
home, really.
Lassie comes.
This is like Martin and Lewis reuniting at the telethon.
So is this thing on? Because I can barely hear.
You
him.
Can't hear him. Hold on, I can fix you that. I can fix that. That's okay. Not a that.
It's just like Willie Mays coming back to the Mets. It's amazing.
Well, I can remember though some of the pratfalls too at that point with Willie.
Yeah, it wasn't pretty though.
You didn't make the trip to Citi Field, did you?
I did not make the trip to Citi Field. I don't like minor league baseball, so I did not go to the Mets-Orioles game that night. I didn't know that qualified as a major league game.
You went?
I did. It was really fun. It was really, really fun. And we just discovered, I was with Aaron Yagoda. We had to head out, and I don't know how many people know this. Dale Romans saved a girl's life. She was choking on a hot dog. He did the Heimlich, and up jumped, yeah, popped out a hot dog and saved some girl at the game.
Wow. There's something about that line, out popped a hot dog. I mean, I could do so much with that line.
It came out just now. Tammy gave me the little whisper, ask him about the choking. And I'm like, ask him about the choking? I don't think anybody heard this story, did they?
Have you? The hot dog just came out now?
Well, no, it came out Tuesday night.
Okay.
But Dale Roman's hero.
Wow. And I would have said something this morning if I knew about it.
Now it's out. The story.
Ironically, he's choking on a hot dog at the morning line right now. We just came from there.
He's choking on a breakfast sausage.
So I understand Baffert did the folly floater when he threw the first pitch. He did the Steve Hamilton, right?
Pretty much. I called it an Ephus pitch, and he kind of wanted to make sure. He was told that to guarantee to get it to the catcher to aim over his head. So he gave it the kind of the high pitch, and the catcher had to come out of the crouch to
That's
grab.
Like, what do you call, what was that pitcher? Sewell.
Yeah, Rufus. Rip Sewell. But no, in the 60s, the Yankees, Steve Hamilton, big lefty from Moorhead, Kentucky, threw the folly floater.
Rip Sewell did it in the All-Star game to Ted Williams, and he hit it like 400 feet.
Yeah, well, Steve Hamilton did it to Tony Horton of Cleveland, who struck out on the pitch, and then he crawled back on his hands and knees into the dugout. It was a great...
Well, Baffert said that as long as he didn't bounce it, that's the thing.
He was worried about bouncing it.
Yeah, for him and his horse.
Yep. But I'm bummed.
Hey, oh, how sharp are we today? Oh,
it shows you 3 years means nothing.
It's true.
Three years. We just pick it right up. Just as we went with it.
Good.
And it is missed. It is missed. It's well. You got a big audience.
They
came out. I'm used to dealing with that. I just tune it out. But the
came easy and it went just as easy.
Well, we're missed.
They throw darts at us, but they missed them.
No,
I have to say, Steve. By the way, I like your tie.
Thank you.
I like the colors on there.
Thank you.
Nice pastel colors.
Yesterday's was much wilder.
The pink? What was I wearing yesterday?
The paisley pink thing.
Yes.
It was like a Prince concert.
Paisley Park. I was doing a little pink. It's been tough. You know, it'd be nice if spring would show up here and we could break out the seersucker. And I know you've got to be disappointed. You've got your white linen suit that you usually wear.
I have my one sport jacket, which actually is a suit jacket. But the pants are too tight in the crotch. So
two pairs of pants you get with that at Anderson Little.
I only got
Robert
one,
Hall.
And they couldn't get it right. So now I wear pants that are close to the color of the jacket.
Robert Hall clothes. Robert throws them out. You haul them in. Remember that?
It's a menswear.
Bob throws them out. You hope they fit.
Men's warehouse. It's the only thing I've got.
So your crotch is getting bigger now? Is that what you said?
I don't know. Either that or those pants were getting smaller, but they couldn't. I brought it back like three times, and they couldn't get it right, so I just dumped it.
God bless you.
That's pretty funny.
You know, you realize,
without
by the way,
the Viagra.
You realize that all these anecdotes have been saved up for 3 years.
Exactly. You've got to get you got about 40 minutes to use all the material.
We're good luck for the Triple Crown, right?
That's true, right?
That was Aaron Rodgers with the trophy.
That's the one thing those were the greatest. That was one of the greatest moments in show history. We were sitting here, and all of a sudden, Darren shows up with the white gloves, mm-hmm. holding the inverted triangle trophy.
And now we have a new trophy, too.
Which is all right. It's nice. It's nice to look
at. Have you seen the trophy?
Yeah, I saw it the other day at Citi Field. It's nice. It's lovely, but it's not... I don't know. I've got an affection for that. The triangle, the inverted silver triangle was gorgeous.
Well, it was gathering mothballs for so many years.
It's true. And then Baffert put it on his head like a yarmulke. When we were at, remember that night at the Stephen Foster night when they gave him the trophy, he flipped it up and put it on his head.
Well, that's his move, right?
You know, it's bad luck. You're not allowed to touch the trophy before the race. It's very bad luck.
That's
the Stanley Cup you're thinking of, I think.
No, Stanley Cup.
No, it's the conference trophies in the NHL. You're not supposed to touch the conference trophy because you're going for the Stanley.
I think it's with any trophy because I remember West Point had a horse. I forgot. They had a horse in the Belmont. You know, fairly decent contender. I forgot his name, but they all wanted to go pose with it, and Terry Finley wouldn't let him touch it. He said, no, it's bad luck. You can't touch that trophy.
Yeah, I very rarely touch deer heads on walls or any trophies like that either. I pet a boar once in a while, but that's about it.
Morph into this. You mentioned the good luck for Triple Crown, and one of the topics that is really getting, I think, at least attention from people who are really interested in racing, is this atmosphere. That is very different, Steve. I mean, all the ones, it's the anniversary today of Touch Gold beating Silver Charm. We've had, you know, a lot of focus on all the various tries, but it does feel like now that we know it's not impossible, as was feared or in some cases presumed, it just feels like, well, this is a real legitimate chance, but there isn't that desperation and that...
No, it's expected now. I mean, they know he can do it.
I don't know if it's expected. I don't know if that's fair.
Well, I think this horse, I was mentioning that, I think this is a very polarizing horse. I think you either think he's going to win by 10 lengths, or you think that you're going in the opposite direction, that maybe it's catching up to him, all this racing crammed into a short period of time. So it all depends. I don't think there's a middle ground. I don't think people say, I don't know if he's going to win or not. I think you either love him or you... don't like him at all.
Well, Bob Baffert just made the same point you did, Steve, at the press conference he just did. He said, the difference in this time is last time we were really wondering if it could be done. You know, there was a real if there, no matter who the horse was, can it be done? And now it's a much different vibe to it because, you know, it's 3 years and not 37 years. You know, it's a hell of a big difference. And I think, well, let's face it, I mean... This isn't like the Smarty Jones ownership group where it's like a huge people story, you know? The ownership group is almost like a conglomerate of four or five different entities. And Bob being the one coming back, you know, 3 years later again with the Triple Crown try. It's not a warm and fuzzy feeling. However, if you have seen this horse run, if you've seen this horse in person – You start to understand what a special individual this is, and even though it doesn't have that warm and fuzzy aspect to it, I think we could be, you know, we're sitting in the middle of history here. I mean, Baffert is rewriting the history books, you know, by the classic race, classic race. I mean, we're in the middle of a history writing experience here, and this horse could be a historically good horse.
Well, you talk about not paying any attention to superstition or anything. A lot of people, you know, you win the Derby and the Preakness, you wear the same tie, you wear the same shirt, you wear the same jacket. They're changing silks. I mean, that's a totally unprecedented. You know, the heck with the Windstar silks, but, you know, they're going to put on the China Club silks. But when you win the first two legs and then change silks for the Belmont Stakes, you're flirting with fate.
That's when you're confident, I guess.
You got to be confident. The only thing horse I could invoke on that was Curlin doing the revolving silks.
But with Curlin, they alternated. But they had so many owners. He had four silks, so that was totally different. And Curlin didn't win the first two legs. Hey, you got the first two legs, you know, wearing the Windstar silks, and now you're changing. Listen, nothing against Windstar, but this horse looks much more smashing in the China Club silks.
Really?
With the orange and the yellow sleeves and the stars, with that red chestnut coat.
Interesting. It's a feng shui kind of thing.
By the way, I have to say,
Steve's doing color blending here.
Well, I tell you,
the green clashed with the red, I guess.
I can't tell you how distracted I am, by the way, by the smell of garlic wafting from that bag.
The everything bagel.
Bagel is just reaching out at me right now. That
I went with egg. I went with the mundane
wham.
Egg.
It's exuding. It's exuding fumes from the bag. It's coming right into my face right now. So I'm overwhelmed by garlic.
We've had worse smells in this place.
Morph into analysis mode and what you anticipate here, respectively, Lenny.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who Steve referred to as very confident in the horse. I think there's one horse that can beat this horse, and that's himself. I don't think there's anyone else in this field that can beat him, all things being equal. Mm. Do things happen in these races?
Yes.
Absolutely they do. You have to break. Look, Big Brown, you had a starter on the track. Stuff happens, let's face it.
And remember, a horse stepped on his shoe and bent, he ran the whole race with his bent shoe.
Exactly. So stuff does happen, but all things being equal and on their merits, I don't think there's anybody good enough to run with this horse.
Well, the thing is, if any horse is made physically for Belmont Park, it's this horse. With his size and his stride, if you go back and look at the four most dominant Belmont winners, you look at Secretariat with the 31 lengths, you look at Risen Star, 14 and 3/4 lengths, you look at Point Given with 12 and a quarter lengths, and Easy Go with 8 lengths, the one thing they all had in common was that they were big, strong, strapping horses with huge strides. That's what happens when you get a big horse like this. Why do you think Forgo was able to circle horses 5 wide on the turn and still come and catch and catch Honest Pleasure and draw off in all those races? That big stride of his, these turns are so conducive to a long striding horse that from that aspect of it, he should absolutely relish these turns. And that's where you won. Why do you think Easy Goer beat Sunday Silence? Sunday Silence was great on the sharp turns. He had that big turn of foot. Easy Goer had the ankle problems and really couldn't accelerate and keep up with him. But on these big turns, he turns into a different horse, and he just blew right by Sunday Silence like he was standing still. So that's the one thing you can look forward to. When Point Given ran to Belmont, I predicted that he was going to win by a huge margin, and he won exactly. And the way you win the race is on the turn. You just blow the whole field away on the turn, and you just keep going here. You just don't come back.
You know, it's kind of interesting when one team is undermatched against another team in a basketball game or whatever. Sometimes you'll be out there and you watch the pregame and you see the one team sneaking a look across the court at the other team, you know, and the headlines they've all read about, and they want to see for themselves what these guys look like. Every other trainer in this race has an eye on Justify, has an opinion of Justify, has a firsthand experience of having tried to beat him. And I think they're all kind of a little bit in awe. Yeah, I mean, you'll never hear anybody say that, but I think they all have one eye on, oh, my God, you know, can I match up against this horse? He is the measuring stick at this point, and nobody's matched up against him yet.
Well, my favorite quote is in the Preakness when Wayne Lucas got there first, and Wayne Lucas always parks himself right at the end of the shed row where he keeps a close eye on all the horses. And he said, I came here, my horse has galloped, his horse is doing great. He said, I was feeling really confident until I saw Justify, and I realized, and this is Wayne Lucas talking, and I quote, I saw Justify, and I knew I was in deep doo-doo.
Now, there is an element to that, and, you know, you can talk to Chad Brown also. I mean, those folks were so high on Good Magic going into the Derby, and rightfully so. He ran 2 monster races, and, you know, you just have to shrug your head and say, you know, it's an Aladar and it's a sham. Did I just come along in the wrong year with this horse? And I think there's an element of that going around here at this point.
One of the things that, and you alluded to it, Steve, about the polarization, which I find, frankly, repulsive, but for lack of a better word, because it doesn't make any sense. And what's odd is that with all the focus over the years building up to dismissing the Apollo curse, it's become sort of a weird postscript that nobody, that, you know, the people that were saying, well, you can't win because of no 2 year old, and now it's as if there's a resentment that the horse could be this good. It's like, what are you doing? What kind of crazy response is that to a horse doing something that's unprecedented?
I actually feel sorry for Apollo. I mean, the poor horse. I mean, yeah.
We don't have to listen. We're not going to hear his name again.
Well, you know, not only that, but you have to add that to the fact that before he won the Derby, only one horse in the past 103 years had won with only three starts. And that was Big Brown. And he had run as a two-year-old going two turns. So this horse was combining the Apollo curse without a two-year-old foundation and winning the Derby with only three lifetime starts. And only two have done it in history. The only other one to do it was Regret. I mean, so.
I think you're right, though, Steve. I think this industry tends to eat its own. There's resentment. There's a weird non-celebration of good things that do go on and happen. And I'm not sure people are appreciating what they've seen so far. And I'm not going to take the Belmont for granted like it's a done deal. But let's just examine what he has done so far. I mean, we had TV commentators after this horse won the Santa Anita Derby in his third lifetime start who took it upon themselves to dump all over this horse like this horse is a piece of crap and made the statement that they didn't think they saw enough for the source to even go to Kentucky and run in the Kentucky Derby.
Well, but by Wednesday they had changed their tune.
Yes, and then after the
actually
Preakness,
by dinner that night, apparently Randy Moss says we may have. I think Randy and Jerry Bailey got too many texts about what are you doing.
Yeah, they backtracked a little bit there.
They were right back after the Preakness. They were right back at
back
it again.
Oh, good.
It was right back at it again.
That's funny.
So yeah, was the Preakness their most his most impressive? Right? No. Oh, of course
not. Dale Romans just said that in some ways he thinks it is his most impressive performance.
And I agree. I was more confident.
Like
I was more confident when they crossed the wire there than I was going into that race. I don't think people understand how good a horse Good Magic is. And to look at him eyeball, or maybe they just didn't see the race in the fog. I don't know. If you were watching the NBC, I don't think you could watch the race. But to eyeball that horse for a mile, put him away. And, you know, yeah, okay, the closes were closing, but you know what? Mike Smith knew where the wire was also, so I think he moves forward off of that race, and I would be more encouraged after that race than looking for the weakness.
Well, you know what? To put it in perspective, you go back at one point early in the year, Bob Baffert had three of the leading contenders for the Kentucky Derby. McKenzie was his big horse. He had Solomini, and he had Marino, who had just won impressively at Oaklawn. This horse had not even started. He had three of the favorites for the Derby, and this horse hadn't even started yet.
Right there. Don't move. If you move the head, you move the hand.
Oh.
Exactly.
I got it now.
Exactly.
So Steve Bick and I were out at Santa Anita the same week, back in March, Big Cap Week. And, you know, McKenzie was running in the San Felipe that weekend, right? This was before he got hurt. He was still the big horse, right?
Yeah.
And I had the pleasure of interviewing the top two names in the business that week, Bob Baffert and Steve Bick. And but, you know, I've told the story, but you know, McKenzie was obviously the big horse. I get done interviewing Bob Baffert for an hour and put the notebook away, and he goes, you want to see the Derby winner? And I knew the way he asked me the question that we were not going to see McKenzie right then. And Justify had raced once.
He'd had the maiden win, and of course, this was actually not San Felipe. It was Big Cap weekend.
Yeah.
But you had Right. And
it was
had
the
justified,
Baltimore McKenzie race.
Right. And Justify was going to run on Sunday, the next day.
Yes. Yeah.
In the allowance race.
And so having raced once, and for Bob to say you want to come see the Derby winner, I mean.
Well, a similar story, which is my favorite story, which I led my wrap-up story, was Rick Hammerly, the racing secretary at Santa Anita. He had a maiden race carded February 18th. And Bob Baffert comes in his office and said, look, this race has to go. I mean, make sure this race fills. And so Rick asked him, he says, well, why is this race so important? He says, because I have a horse in there that could win the Kentucky Derby. And Rick goes, wait a second. It's middle of February, and is a first-time starter? And you got three of the favorites, and you're telling me you got a first-time starter running in a maiden race that you could win the Kentucky Derby with? So, I mean... Rick Hammerly was like totally flabbergasted by that comment. So, I mean, well, it just shows you when Bob Baffert is that high on a horse, he knows what he's talking about.
And everybody in the horse business can relate to this, to have a situation where for 4+ months, you need every day to go well, without a side slide, mm-hmm. without a back step, without a hiccup. You know, for anybody who's listening who's a horseman, you know how rare that is with any horse at any point in time. Well, nothing has happened that has sidetracked, and they need it every day with this horse, and they got it.
That's even more amazing. You talk about the Preakness, what he went through running head-in-head with Good Magic the whole way. People forget he came out of the Derby injured. Yeah. He had a bruised foot. He did not training at all. I mean, for the first, 4 days, he practically walked the shed, and he had no works. He didn't even have really a real stiff gallop. He went into the Preakness off the Derby with hardly any training and recovering from a foot bruise. And to get looked in the eye by the two-year-old champion and the Breeders' Cup Juvenile winner, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think that's the most underestimated performance, perhaps, that we've seen in a long time. I think visually it played tricks on a lot of people.
I don't disagree, and of course none of this is a preclusion to him not winning. That's why we put him into the gate, and that's why this list of wildly diverse confluences of events derailed California Chrome, I'll Have Another, Big Brown, Smarty Jones, Funny Side, War Emblem, Charismatic, Real Quiet, Sunday Silence, Ali Sheba. And by the way, today would be Jack Van Berg's birthday. And,
oh, really?
And our hearts and thoughts.
I go back even farther. I go back to Forward Pass.
And
I've seen 21 horses try for the Triple
21.
Crown.
21.
Isn't that an amazing stat?
That is. That's unbelievable.
I've seen 21, starting with Forward Pass, and then the following year, Majestic Prince. Going back, that was 50 years ago. And that was my first horse trying for the Triple Crown.
And then Canonero and Spectacular Bid, Pleasant Colony. Ali Sheba is the overlap. And then before Steve, I was going to ask you about Pensive and how he looked that day.
Listen, there were other horses like How I King.
That would have been at Aqueduct, right?
Yeah, yes. Well, that's when they ran.
They ran at Aqueduct. Yeah, people don't... That would have been a weird... That would have been a very strange circumstance had Kauai King won that day. Because how would that have been viewed, Steve, historically, actually?
I think it would have it would have put a whole different spin on the Triple Crown, because Cowboy King was not really that good a horse. He got good for a while. And you got to remember that crop that Derby was running against, Buck Passer and Graustark, the two super horses, both got hurt and missed the Derby. So he was beating horses like Advocator and Blue Skies. I mean, you know, horses that really weren't that good. And you want to talk about Crazy Triple Crown. What a Forward Pass had won.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you talk about the asterisk of all asterisks.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of Dancer's Image and the disqualification.
That's why I just did a whole column on Stage Door Johnny. You know, we owe him a lot, Stage Door Johnny, who had never run in a stakes race before when he beat Forward Pass. And Forward Pass ran a hell of a race. Forward Pass finished like 11 lengths ahead of the third horse in that race. And Stage Door Johnny came and got him. Only beat him a length and a quarter.
You know, one of the – and I missed that piece of yours. Did you and I bring this up? Somebody I brought this up with. Maybe it was with you several weeks ago. Dancer's Image also getting disqualified
in the Preakness,
which nobody ever discusses.
Yeah. I know. That was amazing. For him, after everything that happened in the Derby – which I think everybody can tell you right now, that was a total bogus disqualification.
Correct.
What Peter Fuller had to go through for years and years and great expense. But, yeah, then he comes and gets disqualified legitimately in the Preakness. One of the horses he bothered in there, by the way, was, believe it or not, No Double, who turned out to be a hell of a good horse.
Wonderful, wonderful horse that we talk about with Dash Goff when we were at Arkansas 2 years ago. Some of the other ones they're kind of lost to history. There have been a couple of injuries that we think of.
Bid with the safety pin.
Right, but there was also the fact that Tim Tam, very similar.
He fractured his leg at the quarter pole.
Yes, I mean, very similar to a Charismatic. And you also had, much like I'll Have Another, you also had the circumstance where Bold Venture had gotten hurt and didn't get to start. I mean, there's been certain harmonies in this that are really amazing.
Well, I'll tell you, my favorite one was Green Tree had 20 grand, who's a Hall of Famer. And 20 grand won the Derby by like 4 or 5 lengths, won easily. And in the Preakness, they put a stablemate in with him,
as Bob is doing.
So, and as Todd has done in a lot of races by putting stablemates in there. But what happened in that race, if you look at the footnotes, 20 grand is making his move up the rail. And gets completely shut off by his stablemate, who was a no-hoper, who had finished like 13th in the Kentucky. He beat one horse in the Derby. And for some reason, it was a horse called Surfboard. And you could see it. He says he got stopped by his stablemate. And then he came on again and was flying at the finish, just missed, finished second, and then won the Belmont by 10 lengths in a three-horse field.
Yep. I wrote about that years ago on Derby Trail. I went through there's crazy. I referenced Bimelec earlier. I mean, Bimelec should have won the Triple Crown. I mean, there's so many. We've discussed Damascus a million times, how he fretted all Derby day. The noise and the tumult was torturing him.
It was a combination of things. Frank Whiteley alluded to me in his later years that he really thinks that somebody might have gotten to Damascus because he was not acting himself the whole time in the barn, and that's why he was fretting going to the track. And then Churchill Downs wouldn't let his regular lead pony, Duffy, who was like his best friend, he used to nuzzle up against him all the time. They wouldn't let him serve as his lead pony on the track. And Damascus just fretted, and, you know, he got beat by Proud Clarion and Barb's Delight, who came back and trounced in the Preakness and then won the Belmont, and it became, you know, to me, one of the greatest horses of all time. But he definitely should have been a Triple Crown winner, and certainly Slew should have been a Triple Crown winner. But you know what? Back when Slew was saying it was a foregone conclusion.
He was a Triple Crown winner.
And that's Slew Bid, I mean.
Of course. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
What's interesting, I think my colleague Frank Angst may be doing research or a story on this is the fact that we have so many in the Belmont this year, and historically
that has hurt.
You know, going back in time, you know, these were typically 4 and 5 horse fields a lot of times.
A lot of three horse fields.
A lot of them. I looked at them all. Even with American Pharoah having 7 opponents, the average of all the Triple Crown winners of the opponents were 4.6 opponents in the Belmont. And if you go back to some of the earlier ones, like Alan Fox and all, there were 2 and 3 horse fields.
Yeah.
Three horse fields. 3 horse fields, 4 horse fields. It was so easy to win the Triple Crown because you didn't have all these horses laying in wait. I mean, they weren't. Usually when they ran into Belmont Stakes, there was nothing really left.
But the Derby horses all ran in the Preakness, so yeah. Everybody was in the same boat as opposed to, you know, right. Coming in against fresh horses. All
and
the time.
Thing is, and the weirdest was Assault. Here's a Triple Crown winner. He's the only Triple Crown winner who was not the favorite in the Belmont. Because there was a horse named Lord Boswell that was closing in on him in the Preakness. And he just held him off by a neck. And everybody thought, okay, going a mile and a half now. Because Assault, early in his career, wasn't that great a horse. He was like a real quiet type. And then going into Belmont, they figured, well, Lord Boswell almost caught him in the Preakness, going a mile and a half. And Assault wound up winning the Belmont by the length of the stretch. But, I mean, to go for the Triple Crown and not be the favorite, that's pretty weird.
Which of the ones, and I suppose it's more... More on the modern front, but which was the most disappointing? Which one? Smarty's hard to argue with. I said that. I knew as I asked. For you too, Lendy.
Yeah, and Bid. I mean, with Bid, it had happened 2 years before that, so it was like no big deal. Oh, I got another Triple Crown win, a big deal.
I have to be honest. Until Pharaoh. I really never believed any of them would win the Triple Crown. Going into the race. And, you know, I think Big Brown, I mean, so many people had drank the Kool-Aid on it, and he did do amazing things. But, you know, if you walk in the barn area that week, there, you know, you've got people working on his feet, like, for 10 hours a day. You know, it's like, hey, you know, guys, this may not be as smooth and easy as you think it's going to be. So, really, I maybe it's a case of show me, you know, because I haven't followed it as long as Steve, and I really didn't, you know, hadn't seen from my own eyes, certainly in person, anybody actually win it. So it was prove it to me, and I think Farrah was the first time I really thought it was going to happen.
Well, you know what the twist was? There was a major twist with Ali Sheba, and people don't talk about it. You know, Ali Sheba looked like who was going to stop him? He'd already beaten Bet twice. He had beaten all these horses in the first two legs, and he looked like he can go a mile and a half. But back then, no Lasix in New York, and he had to come off of Lasix, and that's what they blamed it on it. And that's why when Ali Sheba was a four-year-old, they decided to run him without Lasix to prove to everyone that he didn't need the Lasix. And he wound up winning the Haskell without Lasix, and he wound up winning the Woodward without Lasix. But that's what everybody blamed it on. Back then, it was a big thing, you know, not being able to run on Lasix in the Belmont Stakes.
Which can lead us to the Dark Horse special that
I had Joan watch it last night. She absolutely loved it.
The raves have been absolutely pouring in.
I've seen it three times already.
And I hope, you know, for all the carrying on about a half-wit comics attempt at humor.
Well, nobody should pay attention to that.
It was just
moron.
Preposterous. This should be getting the attention because this, you know, this is a network as well that devoted, you know, resources and multiple, you know, multiple airings of the easygoer Sunday Silence rivalry and brought new information to light and new angles to light. I mean, the Eclipse is already locked in for this.
Well, to me, what made it more compelling, listen, I've seen rivalries before, and this was a great rivalry, but the story with the two brothers is what made the story. It was like right out of a 1940s movie. You know, you expected Walter Brennan to be in there somewhere. I mean, really, you couldn't make that up, you know, between the Phipps connection and the two brothers trying to take over the father's farm and the whole history of the Hancock family. You know, people forget he changed the face of breeding in this country by importing Nasrullah and Prince Aquilo. So, I mean, basically all the horses come from those two horses.
You know, back when they were doing nighttime soap operas like Dallas and all of those, or miniseries, I should say, you know, really, really, that family and those operations would have been just a perfect subject matter for a fascinating miniseries. I still think there's a great book in it and everything else. And there is a book called something about the Bugle. I forget it now, about the Hancock family. And the great-grandfather was a Confederate, you know, colonel in the war which goes back
to the movie Kentucky, which is the granddaddy of all. Starts out in the Civil War with the two families, a feuding. But you know it's different, and it's something historic. When you got somebody like Arthur Hancock, even in his 60s, referring to his father as daddy.
Yeah.
You know, it is, you got to love it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's that is a great story. And going back to Sunday Saws, I mean, nobody wanted that. The horse almost died when he was a foal.
Yeah.
The vet told him to put the horse down. It was Thanksgiving. The horse was projectile vomiting. The vet wanted to go to Thanksgiving dinner, didn't want to be around the horse. Well, put the horse down. Let me get the dinner.
Well, the van driver having a heart attack and the van overturning.
Right, right.
And horses were
and nobody wanted the horse. There. The horse was bought back. Arthur bought him back as an afterthought at the sale for $12,000 or $13,000. Took the ticket to Tom Tatham, who had bred the horse, and thought, "Well, what'd you do that for? I don't want the SOB, you know." And, and that's Sunday's silence.
The funny sideline with that Belmont Stakes was how many times Sunday Silence sent Charlie Whittingham to the first aid room. Sunday Silence was a mean SOB, and Charlie had all these wounds everywhere. He grabbed him on the arm, he grabbed him on the side, and it was right here, walking right out the tunnel. We're sitting right next to the gap here, and I was walking with Sunday Silence coming out on the track. The exercise girl, Pam Mabes, was on him, and right at the end here were the camera crew. There was a camera crew standing there. Sunday Silence saw that. He went up on his hind legs and came down and hit Charlie Whittingham right in the head with his hoofs. And Charlie Whittingham's head, and Charlie's like completely dazed. He just got kicked in the head by his horse trying for the Triple Crown. And Pam is saying, "What do you want me to do?" And he says, "Go, just go, get him to the track and back to the first aid room again." And for the rest of the time, Charlie had this spot of iodine on his bald head. It looked like his head was rusting. You know, this one spot of iodine. And I remember asking Charlie, because a lot of people didn't see it. He said, "Charlie, what happened?" He says, "It was nothing." He says, "You know, the horse got spooked." And he says, "And I zigged when I should have zagged." But, he sent him to the infirmary so many times. And finally, like, come Belmont, Charlie was really ticked off. Because we had a torrential rainstorm the day before the Belmont Stakes. And the track was drying out, but Naira closed the track up for training. So the track would firm up for Easy Goer, who did not want to run in the slop. Remember, because you remember the Breeders' Cup, Juvenile. He didn't run very well, and he didn't run very well in the Derby, both the Churchill Downs. So they didn't want to run him in the slop. So Naira closed the track to training. And all the Sunday Sounds people, including Charlie Whittingham, was extremely ticked off that they were catering, you know, to the Ogden Phipps horse. But so much was going on that week. And I remember Charlie's was really getting – people were walking into the barn to get their pictures taken with the horse. And that was the last horse you wanted to take your picture with.
It's the vagaries of this sport that a horse like Sunday Sounds, a horse like Seattle Slough could both be – unwanted horses who then became not only two of the greatest runners we've ever seen, but two of the greatest progenitors, stallions that we've ever seen.
And dynasties.
These are horses that were unwanted for the most part. It's just shush. It's a great sport that way.
Yeah, Seattle Slough was so ungainly. I mean, they called him Baby Huey. Nobody won. 17-5. And they weren't even going to bid on him. And the only reason they bid on Slough was Karen Taylor elbowing Mickey in the ribs to bid one more time because Jim Hill and Sally Hill had left because Jim had some surgery or something to do back in New York. And he said, "Listen, go up to like 15,000 on the horse." And Mickey was ready to quit at 17. And Karen just kept elbowing him in the ribs. And he finally made one more bid and got him. And you talk about a soap opera, what that turned into. Mm. Yeah. A lot of it's amazing stories. That's why Red Smith said he loved covering horse racing more than any other sport because of the stories.
No, and we've discussed that. I mean, whether it's the human connections, it's the riders, it's everybody that attends to a horse in its development, and in fact, you know, that's one of maybe that's the internet's greatest contribution to the sport beyond, you know, the things we talk about every day, and that is the fact that we've gotten much more exposure, you know, for the various people, whether it's those on the farm foaling and raising young horses up to the development of yearlings into two-year-olds and training. That piece by Bill Plaschke in the L.A. Times about Pascal Rivera, who has been with Baffert from day one virtually and is instrumental in the development of every single horse that comes through that barn. And he doesn't make the trips with Jim, like Jimmy Barnes. You know, Jimmy in his own right, of course, more and more exposure. But, you know, Steve, you've done it, and Lenny, you've done it, and trade, you know, the trade pieces have done it. But whether it's the sales, I don't know, all the different points of on the compass, we introduced to more people on the ownership side as well that are part of these stories, and to me that's what the game's most underutilized asset is that we've got this cornucopia of people that contribute and are involved with every single horse, and then you fold in the players, the bettors that then are, you know, are whether they're interested in the human side and those stories and the equine backstory or not, they add, you know, the financial ramification element. I mean, there's so much that goes on that it's irresistible. And why we ever have, why we think that we have to, go out and drag people into this is really, you know, kind of a mystery, because it's basically the best underappreciated or underenjoyed from every angle, not just as a sport but as a vocation. I mean, there's everything about it is appealing.
You know, another bit of irony is that Justify's exercise rider Humberto,
yeah,
was the exercise rider for Firing Line, who ran against American Pharoah, who almost. And I didn't realize until I went
closest.
We went to the barn last week, and I see him, and he sees me, and I saw him. I said, I didn't realize that you were the exercise rider, because I had become very friendly with him, because I had Firing Line was just one of the most gorgeous horses, very just appealing horse to be around, and I became very, very friendly with Humberto, and I didn't realize that he was the exercise rider for Justify. So it's amazing, the intertwining of stories.
You know, going back to what Steve was just saying, Steve Bick, you know, the owners of these horses, you know, are gamblers as well, right? They're no different from the
biggest,
people who are
the
betting on
gamble.
It. It's the biggest
sure.
gamble.
Sure.
And Steve Hask and I were just talking earlier this morning that, you know, Justify was not a slam dunk at the sales. Justify was failed by a lot of veterinarians at the sale.
Four vets, the OCD lesion.
And we talk about this, you know, and one of the great strengths, even though this isn't a horse that Bob Baffert picked out at the sale, one of the great strengths of his organization is they have a vet and they have bloodstock agents who understand what they can forgive in a horse, and a lot of the horses they have gotten historically, they haven't paid top dollar for, they haven't had to. They have been able to gamble on, hey, this horse isn't perfect, but we think we can project to him outgrowing whatever the problem is and become turning into what we imagine him to do. And you have to be a gambler. Again, you know, again, Justify was not somebody who Bob picked out. It was somebody Windstar and some of the other entities picked out. But, you know, you talk about gambling. I mean, you've got four vets lined up, failing the horse, and everybody knows. Everybody knows. And, you know, somebody sees through that and takes mm-hmm. the gamble.
Well, you know who really fell in love with the horse? It was Coolmore. Coolmore was all set to buy the horse. They had lost Scat Daddy.
Buying the first time,
yeah,
at the yearling sale.
Yeah, they had completely fallen in love with him, and it was a Coolmore's vet was one of the four vets that failed him.
Interesting, that's amazing.
And not only that, but John Gunther was debating, because his daughter, you know, Tanya, who does the matings, she wanted to keep him. She had, you know, she had fallen in love with him and Vino Rosso, and she tried to talk her father into, you know, maybe keeping the horse. And he says, "What?" He says, "I tell you what." He says, "I'm going to put a really high reserve on him. So if he meets his reserve, we'll get a great price. And if he doesn't, then we'll get to keep him." So he puts a $499,000 reserve on him, and Winstar gets him for $1,000 more, $500,000. That was the difference between John Gunther keeping the horse. Winstar upped it $1,000 more over the reserve.
And let's give a shout out to the Gunthers here, because in all of this, and I know Steve and I have both done stories on the family, but to breed two horses like Josephine Vino Rosso in American racing, and then also they bred two horses that are running in Europe now, who are winning stakes races over there from the same crop, the same year. You know, from a 30 broodmare band.
Not only that, but you realize that they had a horse. They ran against American Pharoah in the Belmont Stakes with Materiality, who they bred, who won the Florida Derby.
It was a wonderful horse, and I mean that really sad. But Gunther has had a long sustained career, and you know I'm looking forward to talking to him as well.
He's great guy to talk to.
Well, you know, he's I want him to talk, and you know, you've written about him, but you know, he's had a reputation for years as an owner, as being a very difficult owner among trainers, that he's very demanding, and the question I want to ask him is if he feels that, you know, that this pinnacle, really this peak for him and Tanya as breeders, it is a byproduct of his approach and his exacting nature, because it in a lot of ways, I mean, it's as stunning, and it's been funny because we've had a series of these. It's amazing how almost every year there's some standout breeding entity, whether it was Clear Sky. You know, Clear Sky had the big powerhouse between Arrogate and Abel Tasman. You had the Macmer Hall had that outlandish.
They would come out with big horses every year, Macmer Hall.
But they still are. They still are. I've got to qualify, because if I don't, they'll be hurt. We're not saying that the era of the Brogdons is over.
Well, Sedina Springs for a while.
And it's amazing.
And they're very good friends with the Gulats, you know.
Randy. Twin Creek.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to John Gunther, I mean, this is a guy who goes by his gut a lot. He's a self-made man, so you can understand that. He goes by his gut, but he also does not give up on broodmares as quickly as other people do. Mm. There are some entities where if this mare does not produce somebody in the first 3 years, boom, out the door, goodbye, get the next one in. John Gunther believes in his mares and gives them much more time to find their way and to, you know, to himself to find the right matings and families.
But. Well, you realize that John and Tanya both told me, by the way, that they have a half-brother to Justify by Will Take Charge. That is more spectacular looking than Justify.
You think he might bring a couple of bids at the
they got a Pioneer of the Nile foal this year.
Yeah. Well, the older half brother just won a stake at the Golden Gate, Lieutenant.
It was really cool, actually, and it was nice to see that that he broke through.
Good looking
Michael McCarthy.
Well, it's funny that they're not your typical breeding operation, because John Gunther really doesn't go to the farm that much because he's from Canada, and
Western
Canada. Western.
Yeah, Tanya watched the Kentucky Derby from France in the middle of the night. And John watched it from a bar and grill in Vancouver.
I love it. That's great. That's great. Well, there's actually, even today, and I'm going to forget, I should have made a note at the time. I think there's two Gunther bred runners on the card even today. And he'll send Take Your Guns in the Brooklyn under his name. He's got Take Your Guns on Saturday.
Wow.
Last gunfighter his jacket. Which
says he's got the maroonish jacket with the blue ball, right?
Yeah. Watch out, by the way. I forgot his name. Was it Funny Cat? Is that the name of the horse? The French horse that's in that race? That was coming off a race, the Prix de Barbeville, which was.
The Barber of Seville?
The Prix de Barbeville.
Figaro.
The Prix de Barbeville. That's a prep. It's a mile and 13/16 prep for the French St. Ledger.
Mike is now too close to your mouth. Yes, too close. There you go.
I've been on here for an hour, and I'm still haven't learned how to use it.
It's your French accent.
yes, two years that- 2 years at the Sorbonne, and she still gets it wrong. Welcome to our humble chapeau. Yes.
The thing is, when you talk French, by the way, you tend to caress the mic so it gets closer to your mouth. You know, I feel like Edith Piaf.
You well, look like Edith Piaf.
And you eat like a sparrow. But
nice.
Huh? Do you know he's a bird watcher? Are
I
you
do,
aware
I,
of that?
I'm okay. Well aware. Yes.
What's the word for that? What's the...
A bird watcher.
No, there's a ornithologist. Fancy word. Thank you. Yes.
Well, that's not a bird watching. Ornithologist is...
The study of birds.
The studies birds. That's a scientist. Not a person with a pair of binoculars.
And a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in
right.
pocket.
That's pretty much it. That's what's... You realize how many times we've been sustained by peanut butter and jelly sandwiches out in the tundras of Maine?
Waiting for that Arctic turn.
Yeah.
People all have propellers on as their hats.
As the Arctic turns.
The praise is rolling in for the return of Shulman and Haskin. And...
That's a porn site you have on your computer. That's not praise.
Do you notice that since I retired, by the way, that your name is now first?
Never.
Was it Shulman and Haskin, Haskin and Shulman?
Bob Baffert in his press conference yesterday gets up on the mic and somebody asks him about what silks the horse is going to be running in on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, you know, it's the China Horse Club. And he thinks about it for a second. You know, I wonder if anybody going for the Triple Crown has ever, like, worn different silks. You know, during the thing, he goes, somebody asked Steve Haskin that.
I would have died. If I was there, I would have absolutely died.
Well, and the answer...
Not even a bird watching question.
The answer is no, but, well, I...
The answer is no.
Yeah, the answer is no. I mean, they're going for the Triple Crown. It's happened, as we talked about with Curlin, it's happened in the Triple Crown, but not under these circumstances. I don't think that's going to be a deciding factor.
Well, I think Curlin actually wore three different silks in all three races.
Yeah.
I think it's very odd that the horse is going to be wearing a wheels-up cap during the race, though. That to me is odd.
It's a little over the top.
That's a little odd, I think.
Well, you know? we're moving toward that to that merchandising. We are. There's going to be advertising on silks and things at some point. I mean, that even with the jockey club's opposition, that is going to happen. I mean, it's inching closer. But it's all right. It doesn't bother me. I don't know why it's such a
hey. In the middle of hockey games and baseball games now, they say hold on for a second, and all of a sudden you're on a split screen and there's an ad barking at you in the middle of a game. I mean, these things never happened before.
No,
it's despicable. It's awful.
Well, and look, I mean, Haskin's merchandising Donegal. You've switched. Jack Wolf can't be happy with you.
You send it, and I will wear it.
He had a lobby for this one. He had a work for
really?
This
I
one.
Was, yeah, I yes, was just kidding yes. around.
He had a work
we
for
had,
this
we,
one.
We had Jerry Crawford on our show, and I was just kidding around. I said, so when am I going to get a Donegal cap? He says, oh, no, we'll send you. I said, Jerry, I'm only kidding. Next thing I know, the jacket comes in there and a cap.
He wasn't kidding.
No.
I was kidding.
You weren't kidding. Please, nobody kids about that.
You know why I lost the Starlight jacket? Because of you. Because you were covering the distaff at Hollywood Park in the middle of the night, and I took my jacket off and put it on the chair, and I left without it. All because you were covering Royal Delta's distaff.
It's my fault.
It always is.
You went to the Zenyatta party. That was your problem. Sure, you left me.
He's never. You know what?
He's never
left the Zenyatta party.
Nobody talks about her anymore. Lane Zen doesn't let anybody see her anymore, so.
Really? She's being kept?
I don't know anybody that's seen her. I don't even ask to see her anymore.
Like Melania.
True.
Zenyatta was on a much better winning streak than Melania.
I've got Pete Fornatale and Steve Crist waiting in the wings.
Uh-oh.
Speaking of not being not seen, it'd be nice if Steve came out of Manhattan and we could him out here.
You realize this is my first time here since American Pharoah's Belmont.
Really?
Yes. My first time here.
Well.
Do The old place hasn't changed.
No, at all. And
except for all these fancy tables in here and no coffee.
I got your bagel.
Remember they used to serve bagels and Danish in there?
In here.
Yeah.
Yeah, in there, right. What am I talking about? In there. Yeah, now there's not even any coffee.
No, I know. It's a little, well, I brought my own. And Steve Carlin was nice enough to bring these bagels, and they're yours.
All of them?
You can have the whole bag.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
See, he turns down nothing.
No, he is. He's
bagels? Why would I turn down bagels? You want some?
Huh?
You want some?
I just had one.
He's like Nettie, you know, with the rolling cart coming from the Gristides.
I can't afford Gristides.
Nobody
coming from ShopRite.
Nobody's seen the inside of their house either. Who knows what's going on in there?
I was there once.
We're inside.
Inside the house for about 8 minutes. I saw the downstairs.
I don't even remember that.
When I picked you up when we went to Delaware.
Oh, that's right. I actually let you in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you bird watch while you were there?
Well, it was. It's a lot like what was the gardens, the Glenview Gardens? What was the mother and daughter?
The Gray Gardens.
Gray Gardens. Right. It's a little bit like that. It's a little bit. A little bit. No. It was lovely. It was lovely. And 700 bird feeders in the backyard.
Listen,
that's usually, why you can't afford Gristini.
Usually at this hour, by the way, it's very rare that I'd be dressed. So
he's in his Donegal pajamas usually with the Jack Wolf slippers on. The bunny ears.
I gotta get him wherever I can. I don't go out and buy. I haven't been to a clothing store in 20 years.
With the pants that are too small in the crotch. Everybody's going to walk up to Steve Saturday and look straight at his crotch when they see him.
It's going to be like a rummage sale. They're going to be bringing bags, like the shopping bags of clothes to rummage.
You know, I'm working the...
And he'll take them.
I'm working the secretariat booth on Saturday. That's why I'm coming. And I've got to ask Leonard Lusky the most important question of all. I know he's got seats. Are these seats or in a box? Because I have to know whether I have to wear a sport jacket or not.
Yeah, so let's plug that.
Yeah,
plug
that
while
you're
on the air.
We got to wrap
here.
Up. Do some plugs. Where are you going to be?
Well, we're going to be at the secretariat booth right in the grandstand by the secretariat mural or whatever it is, and near the elevator. And I will be signing my photographs of secretariat from 2 o'clock on and all through the day. Ron Turcotte, Jean Cruguet, Julie Crone, and Victor Espinosa will be signing posters, so we will all be. And Steve Bick just takes out Bob Baffert's book,
the only unauthorized autobiography right. in the history of publishing.
I had to threaten him with that.
An unauthorized autobiography.
I threatened with that. I couldn't get him to interview for it. I couldn't get any time. I said, Bob, you're in danger of being the first person ever to have an unauthorized autobiography.
Well, if you had not said that, I would have forgotten to have you sign. I bought this at that half-price bookstore out on Hurstbourne, out on Outer Hurstbourne, and I say half price. It was like $7.99, but I thought, what a great opportunity. I had not seen it. It was it's a pristine copy.
Yeah.
And what it is Dirt Road to the Derby, the Bob Baffert story. And Steve has told the story on air about the having to mutcher Baffert for months to get him. And the publisher was screaming, where's my manuscript? And finally, Steve, after making up stories.
I told him, I said, Bob, I have to write this book one way or the other, whether with you or not, I'll make up the stories. Well, you know how many times he'd start a story and then wouldn't, and I'm listening to it on tape. I'm saying, Bob, please finish the story. And he does. I go, oh no, I got to finish the story for him.
You know, this book came along at a very good time, but so much has happened since then.
Oh my God!
Oh, there'll be another 18, story.
18 years ago. You know, I told him, I said, why are you rushing in? The guy's been training for 3 years. People know who he is for 3 years. Wait a while. But there is a lot of good stuff in that book. Yeah. The old Silver Charm story in there is interesting. How Ernie Paragallo almost got Silver Charm.
And I'll be at a condo conversion in Patchogue later this afternoon if anybody wants to come by.
Yuck, yuck.
I read Lenny's book. It's very good. Lenny's written two very, very good books.
Thank you. Points on Amazon. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, both books, too. We should also talk about Long Way Home.
Long Way From Home, yeah. Yes, yes. Well, you know, once you buy one, they'll hummel you with the other one. So, yeah, it's a package deal.
And Lenny has got a piece that is forthcoming with all the discussion of Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, and you unearthed every living contact that basically
yeah.
that knew Sonny Jim.
Yeah, it'll be in the June 23rd Blood Horse, and it really I not because I wrote it by any stretch, but it's a fascinating piece of Triple Crown history and New York history, because as we sit here today, there's still only one trainer who's won more than one Triple Crown, and that's Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, who had a 78-year career among horses here. You talk about a guy who was born to be on the racetrack. His home in Brooklyn predated the Sheepshead Bay racetrack. They built the Sheepshead Bay racetrack on a spot that his childhood home was in the infield of that racetrack.
That's wild.
So he actually predated being on the racetrack.
They're
at
running
Sheepshead Bay.
And today, on a historical note, as we wrap up with Steve and Lenny, they are running the Astoria, which started at Gravesend. And the first winner of the Astoria.
The first winner. God, I don't know.
And she has a stake named after her. Astorita.
Really?
And that's how I never knew Astorita.
I remember they used to run the Astoria and the Astorita together. I mean, one would lead to the other.
Well, and there's actually another. I'm not going to have a chance really to talk about
Ruffian it. Ruffian won the Astoria.
Yes, she did, as did Meadow Star and a whole bunch of terrific fillies. Jersey Girl may have been, I know that it's his first grade one winner, Pletcher, but it may have been his first stake winner. It might have been that Jersey Girl's win in the Astoria. The races also today, and with you sitting here, it's appropriate. I'm going to send out something later. The fact that they're running the Intercontinental and the Wonder Again together concurrently, and how intertwined their careers were, at least for a good year plus, in the summer of 04 through the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Turf of 05. And it really is quite something. I mean, they were in the same race together four times. Intercontinental finished ahead of Wonder Again twice. Wonder Again beat her once in the 04 Diana, and they were both beaten one time in that fourth race by Sand Springs. And when you look at these two, at Intercontinental and Wonder Again, the names are unbelievable. Filmmaker, Ouija Board, Ticker Tape. It's on megahertz. It's one superstar turf mare after another. And it was so much fun. This morning I'm writing up my selections, and I go into the proverbial rabbit hole on the three stakes today. Really nice.
Turf fillies back then.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. And Bobby is my aside.
Of course.
Because, of course, Intercontinental, boy, I was with Jimmy Toner in the paddock, and in fact, I met Bobby Flay and Stephanie March that day. They were in the paddock with Jimmy for Wonder Again, and it was here. And I could tell on the backstretch, Intercontinental was just loping along, and I she wasn't on my tickets, and I thought, oh, my God, she's going to wire this field. It was clear. Bayerano was just loping along. I was like, oh, my God, and that's exactly what happened.
Bobby had that other good filly, Starine.
So many. Just unbelievable. Well, this was just unbelievable, and we looked forward to it for months. And
Steve will be eating bagels for months now. It's
wait,
perfect.
Wait until I return my rent-a car today, by the way, when they
the
open
seats,
up the door to clean the car.
The seats are
going to be like Seinfeld, by the way. That smell, the garlic smell will never, ever dissipate from that car. 6 months from now, somebody's going to rent that car and go in there and go, whoa, what is that?
Too funny. A wonderful hour, as always, with Lenny Shulman, Steve Haskin, and they're off.
And they're off.
Literally.
Yeah.
And they're off.
We are off.
Oh, do you have a pick?
I think I'll go with Justified.
Yeah. Lenny, you made your pick.
And I got to go with the Gunther Exacta.
That's what I put on Express.
I'll go with the Baffert Exacta.
I don't mind that either. I picked Restoring Hope Forth.
I'm also looking for Hoffberg to run. I still think he there's some, you know, a lot of the horses in here, by the way. Wait until the Travers when you start when Hoffberg and Tenfold. These are all horses that are going to just keep getting better and better. There's some really good horses out there.
Steve Askin, Lenny Shulman, nothing quite like it. And we've had so many fun visits like this over the last 13 years, basically. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here. You sure you don't want to take a few more of those bagels?
No, they're for you. I want you to.
I will take them then.
Enjoy
they're
them.
Already in his car. He's
weeks
being
to come.
Nice. He's asking.
He's already portioned them out.
They're already. He's FedExing them to Jersey right now.
That was the most half-hearted attempt to the most half-hearted offer ever.
You don't want any more, do you?
We will. I'll take a break. Our last of the morning that has been just a furious 2.5 hours. And Pete Fornatel is going to join me. And we're going to fold in Steve Crist as well by phone from Manhattan. Stay with us.
How could there be two people named Pete Fornatel? I mean,
my dad and me.
I mean, two people with the same name. The best radio disc jockey of all time.
That's not a. He's the best. He's in the photo.
He's
in the photo.
He made FM radio.
Yeah, you agree?
No, I was just going to tell Pete off the air what a huge fan I was of his dad's.
I mean, that voice was mesmerizing. I mean, just so mellow. And that was FM radio.
I used to skip out a second period in high school and go to a friend's house and listen to Benny W. I'm not kidding.
I mean, really, it was the most mesmerizing, just soothing voice. And to me, that was FM radio. It was the voice of Pete Fornatel.
What was it like in the bassinet to listen to that voice?
I can imagine the story. I can imagine the stories. Well, you know.
No.
Tommy got his pussycat yesterday.
We better go. Back after this.